Hello, Steve. How are you?
How are you?
Do you want more time? Because I've got all, I'm in no hurry.
No, it's fine. The university just called an all-staff meeting about some finance stuff, which I didn't have in my diary when we organised this. But to be honest, I only have a bowl of soup for lunch, so that's all sorted out.
That the link you sent me?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Oh, I don't know if that was written for an academic audience, but I found it really accessible.
I mean, that was the first book that I ever wrote.
Really?
I've never written in a jargon-ridden way. I think it is a fair criticism of my work that it's not the most theoretically incisive research. I don't do that kind of stuff. I think that because pretty much all the work that I do is related to the landscape that is kind of all around us. So I think it's easier to write in a way and about things that people can relate to rather than stuff that's buried in the ground or sherds of pottery that we dig up and get terribly excited by and so on. That is actually all a bit more abstract
Yeah,
to
because it doesn't
people.
look like a pot, does it?
Absolutely, yeah. Whereas if you're talking about the names of settlements, or why fields are a particular shape, anyone who lives in the countryside can think, "Oh God, yeah, no, I can understand that now." So I think I do work that is easier to communicate to people than a lot of my colleagues who might do more scientific research, for example.
Where did you get them all from? Sorry, I'm going off on the tangent now, but
This is the book titled The Gwent Levels.
yes, let me just check the one you sent me.
That is now freely available online.
I'm just yeah the sorry Steve, you've lost my faith. But it is the Gwent Levels, the evolution of a wetland landscape.
Well, that the history of that book. I mean, you will have heard talk of a gentleman called Rick Turner. He sadly died. Well, Rick was he used to work for CADU. And he, in the early 1990s, he recognised that the Gwent Levels were threatened with development, and in particular, the proposed diversion of the M4 south of Newport. Now, back then, I was a research student at Reading, and I was doing my thesis on the reclamation of the wetlands all around the Severn Estuary.
Why were you
And
doing that? Why did you choose that?
The reason, well, looking back, it's slightly odd that my undergraduate dissertation supervisor was working with another colleague up in Gloucestershire on the history of the reclamation, so sort of the areas that Rose is more familiar with.
Oh,
And he
Frampton's
just
and
thought it would be interesting to have somebody look at Somerset and the Gwent Levels. I wanted to do a PhD, and so he sort of gently encouraged me to do that. I started giving odd papers at conferences that Rick went to, so he heard about my work. In a way, what I was doing was exactly what he wanted anyway. And I still remember we were at a conference at, St. Fagans. And after we had a conference, and then some of us were just wandering around the outdoorsy bits, and Rick sidled up to me and said, "Oh, can I have a chat?" sort of thing. "What are you planning on doing after your PhD?" Because he wanted a commission, the Gwent Levels Historic Landscape Study. Now, of course, for me, I mean, this was like somebody was offering me 2 years' work. And Rick jointly funded that with what was then called the Countryside Council for Wales, I think it was CCW, that is now it's morphed into Natural Resources Wales. So they funded it 50-50. But it was only partway through the project that I realised that it was partly funded because of this threat of the M4, proposed M4 diversion. And I haven't got this in writing. I'd love to have this in writing, but one of the early highlights of my career was I gave a paper on my work to a group at the Welsh Office Highways.
Yes.
And once again, this bloke came up to me afterwards and sort of said, oh, Dr. Ripon, very nice to meet you. You know, very interested in your work. Do you realise that you've moved a motorway? And he went on to explain that the work that I did was instrumental in shifting the original proposed line of the motorway was to go right through the middle of Whitson, Goldcliff, Nash.
Really? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So a route that went quite close to the coast.
Yeah.
And it was because I managed to sort of make the case for the importance of this landscape,
yeah,
that they moved it to the northern route.
Wow.
Essentially went along the southern side of the old steelworks.
How phenomenal.
So I know that of course, now the motorway's not going to be built anyway, I haven't got it in writing, but...
That doesn't matter. What was Rick Turner like then? Steve, sorry, I'm recording this. Is that okay? Because I'm going to transcribe it, and I'll send it to you afterwards. But what was Rick Turner like?
I mean, he was lovely. He was one of these people that's quite quiet.
Mm.
Doesn't spout off and so on, no ego or anything like that. Just quietly gets on with things. I mean, he was an absolute pleasure to work with. I mean, he had a long-standing interest in wetlands.
Why?
Because he used to be the archaeologist at Cheshire County Council, I think it was. But he was an archaeologist in Cheshire. When some gentlemen who were cutting peat found a preserved body, and the body was called Lindo Man.
Oh, yes.
And it's the best preserved, what's called bog body.
Yeah.
In Britain.
Yeah.
And Rick was the first archaeologist kind of like on call who went out to see it.
Yeah.
And he sort of oversaw that project.
Hmm.
Then he got a job as an inspector of ancient monuments at Cadw.
Yeah.
But because of his particular interest in wetlands, he was kind of given the Severn Estuary as part of his sort of job description, as sort of like Cadw's man on the levels, as it were.
Yeah.
I mean, he was sort of knowledgeable about wetlands. He absolutely saw the value of them. And I think sort of, without making it obvious, I think he must have known that it was the first time I'd had a proper job. I think when you're that young, you possibly don't get worried about stuff, as perhaps you do a little bit as you get older.
That's true.
He certainly helped guide me through some of the things, for some of the meetings needing to produce certain sorts of documents and so on and so forth. He gently guided and sort of supported me and so on.
Yeah. What remit did he give you then?
Sorry?
What remit did he give you?
It was agreed that had to produce two reports.
Yeah.
One was going to be the published book, which you've read. The other one, which I know has been used a lot within planning departments and so on and so forth. It was never formally published and it had a very limited print run.
Okay.
And that gave like a little description of each character area on the levels. So if you think sort of the area around Nash and Goldcliff, if you look at a map, there's little settlements dotted about.
Yeah.
The field's quite small and fiddly. I mean, that's quite an old sort of medieval landscape. That's one character area.
Okay.
And then you've got, if you go further inland, sort of south of the Llanwern Steelworks, you've got areas of long straight roads, very rectilinear fields.
Yeah.
There's almost no settlements, actually. And it's because it's the latest area to have been drained and reclaimed. It was farmed by farmers who lived elsewhere because those parts of the levels would have been too wet to live in winter. So that's a different character area.
Yeah, yeah,
What this second report did was divide the levels up into sort of these character areas.
Mm.
And and write about them in turn. So it's very much a companion volume to the one that you've read. You've read the one that gives the big chronological, if you like, narrative.
Yeah.
The other really provided a lot of the detail about each area.
Yeah. And is that available anywhere?
I don't think it is.
Really?
No, I mean, there were hundreds of copies printed.
Yeah.
But I know, I think they were all sort of snapped up really quite quickly. I think I've got two copies left, one at home and one in the office at work. It's the sort of thing now that would look terribly dated because, of course, it was done on my little Mac computer rather than, you know, proper desktop publishing and so on and so forth. But nowadays, of course, something like that would at least be made freely available as a PDF.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, when the project started, 1993, there was no email.
So hard to think, isn't it?
I don't know if I had a mobile. I don't think I did back then. So it was a very, very different world. But that was my remit, was to produce those two reports. But as I say, I know through talking to Rick that by the end of the project, I was aware that actually the big remit was to produce a report that would try and move this road and stop this road from going right through the middle of the levels.
And off the record, you did.
which I did until they decided not to build it at all.
Yes. Steve, I've got some questions, but I might. But I wonder if you could just start. This might seem a bit basic, but if you can just introduce yourself and your specialism and your involvement with the Grant Levels and with the Levels Project.
The Living Levels Project.
Living Levels Project, yeah.
Well, as I say, I am Professor of Landscape Archaeology at the University of Exeter.
Yeah.
My interest in the wetlands around the Severn Estuary goes back to my PhD that was a study of both sides of the estuary, and it looked at the changing ways that human communities exploited the rich natural resources of these wetlands, and then gradually started to intensify how they used the wetlands. So rather than just hunting and fishing, they started grazing their livestock, embanking the land, using it for arable farming and so on. And I looked at that over the Roman and the medieval periods. Then I got the job doing the Gwent Levels historic landscape study that we talked about. That was from 1993 to 1995. Then I got a government funded fellowship to do a comparison of wetland use all the way around Britain and Northwest Europe. And then I got the lectureship at the University of Exeter. I've been ever since. And I think, I mean, what I try to do in my work is to sort of cross boundaries. So I love using archaeological evidence, maps, written documents that I can access. I can't read medieval Latin or anything. But I can read sort of 17th century handwriting onwards and so on. So I love looking at some of the old documents, interpreting place names and so on. So I try to be very interdisciplinary.
Is that unusual? Is that unusual?
It's not unusual for a relatively small group that would call themselves landscape archaeologists. It is, to my eternal frustration, and don't write this down, but too many archaeologists and too many historians, for example, will only study one thing. They will do is study place names. Or all they will study is pottery. Or they're only really interested in burial sites, not the wider landscape. All they do is study burials and stuff.
And then you miss context then, don't you?
You lose context. What is often said about landscape archaeology is that you're a jack of all trades and a master of none. And that is true. There are people out there that know a darn sight more about place names than I do.
Yeah.
But I know a darn sight more about landscapes
than
place names experts do.
So to the uninitiated, what is a landscape historian?
Well, I mean, you can use it in two senses.
Landscape archaeologist, sorry.
Hmm. Oh, right, yeah. I mean, in a sense, I would say a landscape archaeologist is a landscape historian.
Okay.
In the sense of somebody who's trying to write the story of a landscape.
Mm. Yeah.
But of course, the normal meaning of landscape history is only to study documents.
Uh-huh, okay.
What distinguishes archaeology is that you study physical remains.
Yeah. Mm.
So archaeology is studying the past through its material remains.
Yeah.
And those would be things that you dig from beneath the ground.
Yeah.
Right the way through to what I tend to focus in on, what we would call the historic landscape.
Yeah.
Which is the present day patterns of fields and roads and settlements and land uses that, although they're in use today, can be 100 years old, 1,000 years old, or they can be 2,000 years old.
So they're above ground?
Above ground.
Yeah.
So on the Gwent levels, quite a lot of those rings and the field boundary ditches are medieval in date, so they probably are about 800 years old.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the far west of Cornwall, have you ever been on holiday to Penzance or St Ives?
I am walking there this summer, actually, on the coastal path.
Well, if you do the coastal path around West Penwith, past Land's End, if you do that stretch, in places, you will be walking through field systems, field boundaries, that are at least 2,000 years old.
Why, really? So what should one be looking for?
This is where, if we were meeting face to face, I could draw you a sketch.
Yeah.
What you'll find is that where you've got a hillside that's on a slope.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm.
The slope isn't smooth.
Yes.
It's stepped.
Okay. Yeah.
And where it is stepped is where you've got a field boundary.
Yeah.
On a okay.
Yeah.
If the field is ploughed over many, many hundreds of years, soil gets washed downslope.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And it builds up behind these field boundaries, which are stone, rubble, and earthen banks.
Okay. Yeah.
And this sort of, so the fields literally, they have like a stepped profile as you go down. And there have been archaeological excavations of these field boundaries and dating of them. And they go back, say, around about 2,000 years.
That's extraordinary.
It's absolutely extraordinary.
Isn't it? Gosh.
I mean, those fields in that West Penwith region are pretty unique.
Yeah. How have they survived all this time?
Almost certainly in continuous use.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it is astonishing to think.
Wow.
It's a very, very special landscape.
So do you identify it from ground level, or do you need to be using a drone or flying over a landscape?
Well, there's sort of two different approaches. The specifics of those West Penwith field systems, that really, I mean, it's obvious on the ground as you look around that landscape, if you know what you're looking for.
Yeah, yeah.
That you've got these very distinctive sort of stepped profiles down a hillside.
Yeah.
And that means that those fields have been ploughed for hundreds and hundreds of years. The soil has gradually got washed down and accumulated behind these banks.
Mm.
So you really need to be in the field.
Yeah.
where you've got the Gwent levels, that the work I did there fundamentally is trying to understand the shapes of the fields.
Yeah.
And you do that really from just from maps.
Yeah. But to somebody who's not an archaeologist, you say understand the shapes of fields, somebody might say, well, so what? You know, what does the shape to field tell you?
Different morphologies of fields.
Yeah.
Are often created through different processes.
Okay.
So, for example, different land uses. So, if you've got very long, narrow fields, they're like little strips of land.
Yeah.
That is indicative of land that used to be in one enormous field.
Yeah.
It was divided up into strips.
Yeah.
As a way of distributing the land equally amongst all members of the community.
Is that strip grazing? Is that what you call strip grazing, or is that something different?
Yeah, I don't know the phrase strip grazing.
Okay, I've heard it here in Herefordshire, so maybe I'm getting...
Right. I think that might be something different.
Yeah.
It would either be used as arable land for grazing, for growing crops.
Yeah.
Or it could be used as meadow.
Okay, yeah.
And the what would happen each year is that all of those strips would be distributed to each member of the community.
Okay.
So if you were quite a big landowner, you might get 5 strips.
Yeah.
If you were a relatively lowly peasant, you might only get 1 strip.
Yeah.
They're sometimes called dole moors. Moor is simply the old English word for a wet, boggy landscape.
Yeah.
But dole, we are of the generation that remembers the word dole.
As in D-O-L-E, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As in the unemployment benefit.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
And the reason is, the common root of it is... To dole out is to distribute.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So the old, almost slang phrase for the dole, being on the dole, comes from this root of this word, which means for an organisation to distribute something.
Okay.
So that's why they're known as dole moors. They're wet, boggy landscapes, divided up into strips. And they are distributed out to members of the community.
Do you know, you said you arrived in, was it the early 90s to do your... so was it the case that before then that it was an area that was overlooked as having this rich archaeological potential? Was it...
Hang on. There'd been a huge amount of work done on the prehistoric archaeology of the Severn Estuary wetlands. So this is sort of pre-Roman evidence.
Yeah.
And a huge amount of work had been done on that.
Yeah.
What we knew far less of was what was going on in the Roman and the medieval periods. And that's partly why my PhD supervisor started looking at this up in Gloucestershire and then suggested that I looked at it for my PhD in Somerset and in the Gwent levels.
Okay.
So I was quite lucky to be almost in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
It's when there was increasing interest in wetlands and a realisation how important wetlands were.
Yeah.
We knew about the remarkably well-preserved remains in the wetlands beneath the surface.
Yeah.
But nobody had really looked at sort of the history of the present-day landscape and how old that was.
Okay, yeah.
And so doing that was the sort of thing that I was interested in, and I was just very fortunate that my PhD supervisor suggested that I looked at a landscape that suddenly was going to become politically quite important, as it were, in terms of the proposed route of this road.
Yeah. It's a massive area, though. The Caldecott and the Wentloog levels. I mean, it's huge, isn't it? Huge area of study.
Well, that's actually quite small to, compared to the Somerset levels.
Really?
Which are, the Somerset levels are even bigger.
Yeah. Is that because they're on the windward side, or is that because is that because they're on the windward side, or we are the?
No, it's just actually it's quite different. The Gwent levels, you've got this area of former salt marsh.
Yeah.
That formed going out from the coast.
Mm.
On the Somerset side of the estuary, what you've actually got are, if you like, a series of former valleys that were flooded by rising sea level.
Yeah.
So, have you ever driven down the M5 from Bristol to, say, as far as Taunton?
Yeah.
Okay. You might... Now I explain to you, you will go, oh, yes.
Mm.
Right, you're leaving, you've crossed the River Avon.
Yeah.
Okay, and you go along that slightly frightening bit where the M5 is terraced into the hillside.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Then you go down a slope and you drive across what are known as the North Somerset Levels.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that, but yes.
That bit, huge wetland. Then you come to the Western Supermare Junction.
Yeah.
And then you go through another cutting.
Yes.
Where it's cut into rock.
Hmm.
You go out the other side, you then go across another flat bit, and then you go, when you get to near Bridgewater, you go into another sort of cutting.
Yeah.
And that's because the motorway is cutting through ridges of high ground between the low-lying wetlands.
Okay, yeah.
So it's very different to the Welsh side,
where
you've just got this one big sort of like coastal marshland.
Hmm.
In Somerset, you've got flat wetlands between ridges of high ground.
Yeah. So would you say, say the work of Martin Bell, for example, could I say that's micro archaeology and what yours is doing is macro?
Sort of.
Yes.
I, to be honest, I can see exactly where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Martin is an archaeologist who sees the landscape more than some of his prehistoric colleagues, shall we say. But yes, Martin's research focuses on field work in specific places.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't get obsessed with one particular place. I look at the landscape as a whole.
Yeah. And you're getting the context of that area and how it all links and works with each other and relates to each other?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I suppose, sort of traditional field archaeology, you could say, is micro.
Yeah.
And a more landscape-oriented approach is more sort of macro.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say one is better or more important than the other.
Mm.
They're different and they're therefore sort of complementary.
Yeah, they feed into each other, I would say. You work together.
Yeah.
I might jump around a bit, Steve. Is that, how long have you got, by the way?
We're probably around for another half an hour or so.
Yeah, sorry, I get distracted easily. Professor John Allen's name has come up. Did you know him?
Yes. Well, do you remember when I said about my PhD supervisor pushing me in this direction? I mean, he was a chap called Mike Fulford.
Yeah.
Who he and I did mention that there was he had a colleague.
Yeah.
That was John Allen.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
So those were the two who were working on the Gloucestershire wetlands at the time.
Right. Okay.
John didn't, he wasn't one of my PhD supervisors,
mm.
but I worked with John on various things over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a remarkable man. Once again, quite quiet and modest and so on. He'd never stand in meetings spouting off like some people do. He was a lovely man, very quiet, but just so knowledgeable across so many fields.
Was he a geologist?
Yes, his background was as a geologist.
Mm-hmm.
He once explained to me how he wanted to spend about 10 years on a particular research topic and then move on.
Yeah.
So he did a huge amount of work on it was a particular geological period, and I can't remember what it was. It was, but like tens of millions of years ago.
Yeah.
Rocks from that sort of period.
Wow. Yeah.
And he was like the world's expert on that.
Cool.
And then he decided, then I think he did something else. I can't remember what that was. He might have got into some type of fossil. I can't remember.
Mm.
But then he got interested in salt marshes.
Yeah.
So instead of something that was tens of millions of years old, he was interested in salt marshes that are only a few hundred or a few thousand years old.
Yeah.
And he started to study the salt marshes around the Severn Estuary as a way of studying sea level change.
Okay, yeah.
Now, he had the most amazing eye.
Yeah.
He'd be out in the field and you'd be talking to him, walking along, and he'd go off on a tangent because he'd seen something 20 metres away.
Wow, yeah.
And so he started to find bits of pottery
in
salt marshes that he was studying. Thought it looked old, so of course he took it to the archaeology department at Reading.
Yeah.
Met Mike Fulford.
Yeah.
Mike had a quick look at this pottery, said it was Roman.
Yeah.
And that is how their lifelong collaboration started.
How amazing. So he only died recently, didn't he, I think?
Yeah.
So he was a member of this, is it Severn Estuary Levels Research Committee that you're on?
Yeah, that was back in the early to mid 1980s.
Mm.
So we're going back a long way now.
Mm.
There was a proposal to build a barrage across the Severn Estuary. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
Mm. Now that would have had huge implications for lots of things, including the archaeology.
Yeah.
So some of the archaeologists who were working in and around the estuary back in the 1980s got together to establish what they called the Severn Estuary Levels Research Committee.
Okay.
Now, the Severn Barrage proposal disappeared relatively quickly.
Yeah.
Because it basically would be so phenomenally expensive.
Yeah.
It didn't get going.
Mm.
But I think it did. It stimulated this sort of group of archaeologists to stay together with this. It's a relatively informal little sort of research group.
Yeah.
And so to say, I became a member of it when I started my PhD in 1989.
Okay.
When my recollection is that the threat of the barrage had largely passed, I think.
Mm.
John Allen was very, very active back then studying his salt marshes, and he'd got interested in sort of medieval reclamation and so on.
Yeah.
Martin had done some work at Breen Down on the Somerset side of the estuary.
Yeah.
And he, I think, was now getting interested on the Welsh side. Mm. There was another remarkable figure in the history of the levels was a chap called Derek Upton.
Yes, I was going to ask you about him. Yeah.
He worked at the steelworks and he was a bird watcher. And he's somebody else with the most amazing eye. He started seeing strange things.
Yeah.
Picking up objects, seeing things in the intertidal area of the estuary.
Yeah.
I don't know who he first reported his finds to. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But once again, quite quickly, he got to know various archaeologists and people that he could report his finds to.
Yeah, and took him seriously as well, I suppose.
Sorry?
And also who took him seriously.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that was the key thing.
Yeah.
So he was spotting little woven fish baskets and so on.
Yeah.
I think he might have discovered some of the first human footprints.
Yes.
That, of course, Martin Bell has spent a lot of his time studying human footprints.
Yeah.
And so on. So there was this sort of... It's just very fortuitous. I think a lot of people sort of being around the estuary and then suddenly being drawn in by this particular threat.
Yeah.
And then kind of sticking together once that threat had gone, simply because it's a remarkable landscape to research.
And it's raised its profile, I suppose, as well.
Yeah.
So does it have any statutory protection?
It does for its nature conservation interests.
Yeah.
I mean, both sides of the estuary are relatively well protected in terms of habitat, ecology-related protection. But unfortunately, there's not really anything big and powerful on the statutory front that protects it from solar farms, etc.
Yeah.
My feeling is that, you know, our special landscapes don't have enough legal protection.
Yeah.
And we're seeing this on the Gwent levels. They're not going to be there in a few years' time.
Do you not think so? Really?
Well, no. I mean, they're building a solar farm at Whitsun.
Are they really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's going ahead.
Why?
There's proposals for a huge one on the Wentloog level.
Yeah, I've heard that one,
And there's proposals for another one at Redwick. And although solar farms don't permanently destroy a landscape, like housing development or a steelworks, for example.
Yeah.
But they'll ruin the appearance.
No, no doubt about it,
And on the Gloucestershire side, once again, when you drive along the M4 from South Wales to Bristol, you go over an equivalent wetland on the Bristol side of the estuary, and it's just getting covered in massive industrial units. I think there's a huge Amazon depot there, for example.
Well, I suppose it's happened in Wendlug already, hasn't it? You know, that has been subject to far more development than the Caldecott side.
Yeah.
But has the wetlands become your specialism, would you say?
Well, it was for, once again, probably sort of 10, 15 years or so.
Yeah.
I mean, I made a conscious decision to move on.
Yes.
simply because as an academic, it's very easy to almost get typecast.
Yes.
To use an acting analogy.
Yeah.
So I absolutely consciously decided, right, I'm now going to start studying other things. So I do quite a lot of work now. Well, I had a period in my life, a bit like John Allen said, you should spend 10 years on something and then move on. I had a period when I did a lot of work on regional variation in landscape character. So why is the Devon landscape so different to Northamptonshire?
Okay.
And so, then I got very interested in what happened when Britain ceased to be part of the Roman Empire, and whether that was actually a really significant change or not. So I had about 10 years studying that.
Is that the Dark Ages, you mean?
Yeah, the start of what are traditionally called the Dark Ages. I think a lot of us would suggest they were quite as dark as they used to be. What is traditionally seen as being the sort of almost like the end of civilization at the end of the Roman period. That actually, I think my work hopefully shows that if you're just sort of like a peasant farmer ploughing a few fields and tending a few sheep, not a lot actually changed, to be honest. So I spent a few years sort of studying that. I've tried to move on from wetlands, not because I didn't enjoy studying them, but just because, you know, a typical academic career is about 40 years.
Yeah.
And I don't think many academics want to spend 40 years studying exactly the same thing.
A change is always good, isn't it, I think?
Yeah.
A change is always good.
One of the reasons why I've so enjoyed my involvement in the Living Levels project is that it has brought me back to a landscape that I studied so intensively for 2 years. For 2 years, that was my whole life. And I do periodically return to some of these wetland landscapes just to do a little bit of work on something that I'm interested in.
Yeah. I asked before, actually, about how much of your work is reliant on aerial views. Do you have to rely... Is that part of it for you?
It's a bit. The bread and butter is looking at maps because they are available in such detail.
So to what age do you go back to?
Well, there's good map coverage for the whole country from the 19th century.
Yeah.
So sort of middle of the 19th century, there's really detailed maps of pretty much the whole country.
Yeah.
But some areas, there are sort of earlier maps as well.
Okay,
so the maps are earlier than aerial photographs.
Mm.
And that also aerial photographs, the earliest aerial photographs really are from the 1940s.
Okay,
but they're pretty fuzzy.
But
there are places where, for example, earthworks, sort of humps and bumps, they show up on aerial photographs from, say, the late 1940s. But those earthworks now have been completely ploughed flat.
So
I think to understand the landscape, you've really got to look at absolutely everything you've got at your disposal. Although I would say it's the maps that are the starting point.
Yeah. I mean, maps tell a story all on their own, don't they? I mean, I love a map. Do you use the, my name's gone, the internal drainage board maps? How far back do they go?
Yeah, I mean, the earliest of the maps that show individual fields and buildings and so on are 1830 to 1831. And those were the earliest maps that cover the whole of the Gwent Levels. And they are an absolutely remarkable source.
Are they?
And they were really the starting point of the mapping in my Gwent Levels historic landscape study.
Really? Has there been a high point for you, or punching the air moment for you in all your work down there?
On the levels?
Yeah.
I don't know, really. Off the top of my head, I don't think I can. I mean, I've had various very memorable moments, but I don't think there is quite one punching the air. I mean, I do remember doing a survey of the intertidal area at Magor Pill with John Allen in February.
Oh, God.
And it was bitterly cold. And that absolutely tested my commitment to archaeology.
Cold and wet.
Yeah, that was awful from the conditions, but it was just fascinating. You know, spending a week with the great man, sort of interpreting all of this archaeology. So, I mean, that was a definite sort of highlight. But yes, I haven't really got the air punching moment. I can think of. I shall probably think of something when we sign off.
But, yeah. What about? I'm not sure this is a silly question or not, but the work you do, is it something that can be used by Let me think how to ask this question as a way of informing the future.
Because that is what the Grant Nevels Historic Landscape Study, I mean, that was all about. And it fed through to another CADW Countryside Council for Wales initiative, which was to produce a register of historic landscapes in Wales.
Yeah.
And it identified 60-ish landscapes of particular historic importance in Wales, one of which is the Gwent Levels. And so the Gwent Levels was the first one of the landscapes in the register to see this sort of really intensive study. So yeah, I think that study really did sort of have an impact in terms of raising the profile of the concept of how important still used landscapes are and the time depth that they have. And there was similar work that was done in England as well. And it was a very exciting period to be sort of working in what at that time was a really new and a really sort of innovative concept.
Yeah.
That archaeologists shouldn't just be grubbing about in the dirt, but archaeologists should be appreciating the historic importance of the landscape all around us. And I think it's something that we take for granted now.
Yeah.
But thinking back to that sort of early mid-1990s, very few archaeologists had any interest at all in the historic age of fields that they walk through or roads that they drive down. They were just roads and fields. They are actually often as old, if not older, than things that archaeologists grub around in the dirt.
It's so interesting, because like you said earlier, it's so relatable, isn't it? It's so relatable. What about, have you had to, so you said you've used, you know, maps and old documents, Doomsday Book. Have you ever used, spoken to locals and asked, you know, for their, you know, folk memory, maybe?
Well, this is something that I wish I'd done more of in the Gwent Nevels Historic Landscape Study. I did talk to Neville Walters.
Oh, wow, he's brilliant.
Have you spoken to him?
I've got... It's one of my best interviews.
There was a lady who worked for the Countryside Council for Wales, and I think her name was Susan Howard, who was my first point of contact at the Countryside Council for Wales, just as Rick Turner was my first point of contact in CADW.
Yeah.
And she introduced me to various sort of local people. But Neville was the one who I remember I spent quite a bit of time. I spent about half a day with him, and he drove me around various places, and we talked about some of the traditional methods of managing that landscape that he could remember.
Yeah.
And I remember he told me he was paid something like sixpence for digging a certain length of gripe.
Yeah.
You know, these spade dug gullies in the surface of the fields. And it was something like sixpence for 30 feet a day or something like that. That is in that book somewhere. I did write that down.
Yeah.
What was really nice was we had a big Living Levels event at the, is it called the Lycett Institute?
Yes, yeah.
And I was sitting at one of the tables, and this elderly gentleman sort of walked past and sort of looked at me in that sort of knowing way. I didn't recognise him, because this was about 25 years ago sort of thing.
Wow, yeah.
But he obviously recognised me. Whether he'd asked somebody, is that Stephen Rippon, I don't know. But he obviously recognised me, and I recognised that he clearly knew me.
Yeah.
I guessed it might have been him, so I went out and we had a nice little chat.
Yeah.
So yeah, I wish I'd done more of that. But the people that I did talk to, I mean, it was very useful. I found out about the sort of the cycle of draining, of cleaning out the ditches, that
yeah.
it's only the major water courses that you would have cleaned out every year.
Yeah.
And then you'd have sort of like this cycle of cleaning the minor reams perhaps every 3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And the field boundaries, a farmer might just clean out two field boundaries a year. So they might have a sort of something like almost like a 30-year cycle, some of them.
Yeah.
And of course, that's how you get the difference in vegetation
yeah.
in these ditches, because you get these different time zones. So, I mean, Neville told me all about that and so on.
Is there a particular feature that is of particular interest to you? Say,
I've always had a soft spot for Whitsun.
Yes.
Which, right from the start of my work, it was obviously a very odd block of the landscape.
Yeah.
And I sort of went so far, I think, in unravelling its history and so on.
Yeah.
And of course, that is in the book. And I do speculate in the book that it might have been associated with Flemish immigrants.
Why? Really? Why?
Well, we know that Flemings were brought to Pembrokeshire
yeah.
in the 12th century.
Yeah.
As part of the English conquest of Wales.
Were they mercenaries?
They would use colonists to sort of settle land.
There were lots of Flemish mercenaries at that time too, weren't
yeah.
there?
Yeah, and it's well documented in Pembrokeshire.
Okay, that's interesting.
Now, Whitsun, I recognise that the morphology of Whitsun is very similar to villages in the Low Countries.
Yeah.
But that's as far as I got in the Gwent Levels historic landscape study.
How interesting.
But I gave a lecture at the University of Ghent, probably about 6 years ago now.
Yeah.
And one of their brighter master students came up to me afterwards and sort of said, he was interested in, because I had a slide about Whitsun and wondered if it was Flemish.
Yeah.
And this student, Gerben, went on to do it as his PhD.
Oh, wow, really?
And sort of he has found sort of morphological similarities.
Yeah.
And there's a local historian that Mark Lewis knows about.
Yeah.
Who has found some links in the documents with a Flemish family who held Whitsun.
How curious.
So it's one of the exciting things about being an academic
yeah.
is you do have to brace yourself for the fact that sometimes what you say is proved right, sometimes it's proved wrong.
It's so nice when it's proved right though, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think those early speculations
yeah.
probably sort of have been proved right through Gerben's PhD and also the research of this historian.
The thinking, Steve, I won't take much longer. Looking at the Wentloog Levels, which has been massively developed, how do you do your work there? Or are you able to do anything there?
The interest in the Wentloog Level, and this goes back to John Allen again,
yeah.
He found a lot of Roman material.
Yeah.
Off of what's called Rumney Great Wharf.
Yeah.
So Cardiff End.
Yeah.
And the Wentloog Level has got this very strange landscape of lots of long, narrow fields, blocks sort of next to each other. Mm. So it's, that looks like, I mean, it could be Roman
yeah.
in date. Mm. And as I say, I mean, it's just gradually getting covered.
Yeah.
In development. I mean, it's a great loss.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I have learned is that you do, however, have to pull back. You can't, if you got terribly upset by every development in every landscape that you'd ever studied,
yeah,
you'd just be a manic depressive.
You're right, frank. You have to detach yourself, don't you?
You do, but
yeah.
When I go back to the Gwent Levels, I mean, I do get a great pang of affection. But it is very sad to see you know, that some areas, some bits of it are getting developed. I think if there had been a positive from the M4 diversion,
yeah,
it might have drawn a line on the map that the planners could have said, no more.
Yeah.
On not developing south of that line.
Mm.
And I had this discussion with various people about the pros and cons of that motorway.
Yeah.
And although it would have taken some land from the levels.
Yeah.
I just wondered whether it might have drawn a line and no development would have been permitted south of it. Mm. I don't know.
Mm.
Because the problem with the Wentloog level really is it's the development spilling in from the Cardiff end.
Yes, yeah.
And there's just nothing to stop it.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I fear for Wentloog. Mm. I think it will go the way of the Avon levels near Bristol.
Yeah.
Which they're just getting covered in development as well. Yeah.
There's not very little space there now, is there? Yeah, it doesn't seem to be much space there anyway. Can I just ask you quickly about the drainage? So you would be looking at that evidence of that as well in your landscape. Yeah. So to me, it seems terribly complicated. So how have you managed to work that out? Is that by referring to the drainage maps? And
I mean, a lot of it was actually quite obvious just by walking around the landscape, talking to Susan Howard, for example, all those years ago. The way that the drainage system works hasn't fundamentally changed probably for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
It's gravity led.
Yeah.
There's not the pumping that you get, for example, on the Somerset levels and have had on the Somerset levels for many hundreds of years.
Yeah.
So it's just a gravity fed system.
Yeah.
Where, do you know the Monk's Ditch?
Yes. Yeah.
You see that? That is one of the channels that is designed to take streams flowing off of the uplands across the levels without flooding them.
Mm.
So that deals with that problem.
Yeah.
Then you've got to deal with all the wet stuff falling out of the sky, the rain.
Yeah.
And that's why you have the gripes.
Yeah.
But they take their water into the fill boundary ditches. The fill boundary ditches drain into the Reens.
Yeah.
And Reens then discharge their waters under the seawall through those tidal sluices. So it's a very simple system.
Yeah.
It's wonderfully simple.
But it's sophisticated because the land is lower away from the seawall, isn't it? So it's effectively going up, isn't it?
Well, no, you just have to dig the ditches deeper and deeper as you go towards the coast.
Right, yes, yeah.
That's the thing. And the other feature which means that it works is because of the huge tidal range of the Severn Estuary.
Yeah. Mm.
So what basically happens is that when the tide is high, the flap on those tidal gates is forced shut. So all the water is held in the drainage ditches in the levels.
Mm.
But then you get this long period when the tide goes down, the tidal gates can open and you then get this very long period when all the water can flow out. So if you had a much smaller tidal range, those tidal flaps could end up being closed for much longer.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
But they're only actually really closed for a relatively short period of the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's also why this gravity-fed system can work, because enough of the water can get out quite quickly.
Do you know the movements of the Severn, you know, it's ebbing and flowing and all that, is that something that's of interest to landscape archaeologists like you?
It's a natural phenomenon. Of course, it's instrumental to the wetlands having been created, but you do get wetland landscapes like that, for example, around the Thames estuary that has a much, much smaller tidal range, much, much smaller.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, but
it's just in the background, really.
In the background, yeah.
Steve, I've kept you far too long. I'm really sorry. It's been so interesting. I'm going to type this up and I'll send it to you so you can look through and cross things out or correct me. And if I wanted to ask any extra questions, I'll put it on that, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Is that all right? Yeah, I'm sure there's something I've forgotten to ask, a glaring gap, but thank you so much. It's so interesting.
That's great. Yeah. Okie dokie.
Thank you so much. You take care. Nice to chat to you.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Steve. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.